I'm Evgenia Kröker, and this is the Piece of Advice podcast coming to you from the University of Oxford. Today, we are sitting down with Jessica Di Salvatore and Lisa Hopmann to talk about state-of-the-art data in peacekeeping and conflict research. Thank you both so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abby, for having us.
I'm going to give our audience just a little bit of background information about the two of you before diving into the nitty-gritty of today's topic. Both Jessica and Lisa are data-driven academics who study whether peacekeeping, whether UN peacekeeping works. Lisa, who is a professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University, looks at the impact of peace operations on conflict dynamics, with a particular focus on violence against civilians. Jessica, who is an associate professor in political science and peace studies at the University of Warwick, examines the contributions of peacekeeping to state building and post-conflict development. So diving into our first question, to evaluate whether peacekeeping works, the measure or outcome against which to judge peacekeeping effectiveness should ideally be clearly defined. In your own work, how do you go about selecting such measures? Is there a consensus among academics on which outcomes should be used? And can you tell us a bit more about recent innovative ways to measure results in conflict prevention, peacekeeping, and peace building?
Okay, I think we've seen a great development in ways that we measure peacekeeping effectiveness over the last years. If we go back in time, we used to think of peacekeeping effectiveness as like either it works or it doesn't. So does peacekeeping sort of hold ceasefire agreements or not? But in more recent years, we've sort of seen much more nuanced ways of addressing these questions. So relative effectiveness, but also effectiveness in different fields, different types of effectiveness. So in my work, I think I've thought a lot about like, what is it that peacekeeping is expected to achieve? I think that's what we need to start if we want to talk about effectiveness. And I've focused a lot on the violence side, which is a way of thinking about the security aspects of peacekeeping. So peacekeeping is, you know, kind of all peacekeeping missions have that core task of improving the security in the country where they are deployed. So looking at violence, to what extent peacekeepers can reduce violence in the areas where they operate, is one way of getting at that effectiveness of the one of the core tasks that they have. But then there are, of course, a lot of other mandate items that these missions come with. And then we need to look at other measures to get at that. And I guess this is where Jessica's work come in.
I agree with the points that Lisa raised, and also generally the question, Evie, about the fact that the measure that we use needs to be clearly defined, it's an important one. I would say that on top of a clear definition of the measurement, also the relevance of the measurement is important. And this goes back to Lisa's points regarding what should we expect missions to be able to do. So there are things that we can have expectations on, but then on other tasks, maybe this is not even expected from UN missions to deliver on these specific goals. And also, we have been able to, I think, reach a point of knowledge accumulation where we know that peacekeepers are good at doing something, less good at doing other tasks. So again, I think we've made several steps in the right direction in terms of evaluating the effectiveness in ways that is more nuanced, but also fair in some way, or just based on actual expectations that the Security Council has when missions are authorized with certain mandates. And on the point regarding clarity and relevance that I was that I was introducing previously, I also think that it's possible to identify some measurement of effectiveness that can be very clear, but at the same time not that relevant. Many things that peacekeepers do are, of course, relevant. Most of the things probably they do are, of course, relevant. But I think that some might have a priority in some way because, for example, this speaks directly to the kind of more long-term implications that peacekeeping missions may have. And here I'm thinking about recent work that looks, for example, at that uses survey data, for example, based on cooperation or cooperation among local communities, for example, between members of local communities, but also with the mission. So I'm thinking about work by Nomikos or Gordon and Young, where they look at whether missions can foster actually that cooperation. And that to me is a very relevant outcome, very policy relevant for sure. And here I'd be willing to give up on the clarity, in a little bit of clarity, because we know, of course, that there can be some problems in how we measure certain things, certain abstract concepts. But I'm happy to give up a little bit of clarity in favor of the relevance of the question that these studies are, I think, helping us with.
I think what you talk about now, Jessica, sort of speaks also to this difference between peacekeeping effects and peacekeeping effectiveness. And I think we need to be clear about that. So in my view, peacekeeping effectiveness is, you know, to reach the goals that the Security Council wants peacekeeping missions to achieve. Like, what are they authorized to do? What are they mandated to do? And then we need to look at those mandates, you know, and measure those various sort of tasks and how well they perform. That's effectiveness. But then there are a lot of other effects and that are also highly relevant. And those could be indirect effects or direct effects, but where we think that peacekeepers maybe should have a positive influence on the conflict countries where they operate. And so, for example, work on health outcomes, where I think we maybe expect the general public health to improve when peacekeepers are present and do their job, but it's not necessarily one of the main mandated tasks that they have. I think, and we need both those types of research questions and projects to really understand the full impact that peacekeeping missions have in the countries of operation.
So both of the things that you mentioned in terms of clarity and relevance, but also in terms of direct and indirect effects, I think these are very important points. I was wondering, coming back a bit to the peace building side of things and trying to measure nonviolence related outcomes, I was wondering whether you could tell us a bit more about how to actually get at the ability of peacekeepers to foster long-term peace, and which outcomes can we use if we agree that this is something that they should do, given that they also have multidimensional mandates in these times. How would we actually be able to judge that they perform at building peace?
Yeah, this is not an easy task for peacekeepers. Depends on many things. So when we think about the breadth of how broad the mandates are, I think it makes it difficult to evaluate them for at least one reason. The fact, for example, that they are interconnected with each other, many of these. So it's difficult, I think, to evaluate effectiveness on such complex tasks like a state building or institution building when all these things in some way come together. You can reform the security sector and then at the same time try to democratize the country and maybe succeed at one but not at the others. This can work. Maybe they can even in some way affect each other. There's also been a lot of discussion, I think, in the UN, definitely among academics. I'm not entirely sure how much that has also crossed the UN policy discussion around the sequencing, the phasing. Maybe we shouldn't be doing all these things together at the same time. And with colleagues, we also have some research on the implementation of mandates that does show that mandates that tends to be particularly complex, not because of the sheer number of tasks, but because they have to do security plus peace building, for example. They may not necessarily work at cross purposes. So actually, this can make the job for peacekeepers even more difficult, particularly if the timing is not ripe for these things. And so I think there's a lot of reflection that should come also in the way the mandates are framed and how much they're asking peacekeepers to do at the same time, maybe phasing things out. It's probably warranted. We don't know really, but I cannot make an assessment about whether this would be better because that's not how this has been done so far. So I don't know empirically what would this imply in terms of the effectiveness of missions.
So Jessica talked about that this is a difficult task for peacekeepers, right? It's also a difficult task for us as academics to evaluate, and you alluded to that a bit. But first of all, we have the selection bias issue. So we want to assess to what how peacekeepers and peacekeeping missions perform on these like general peacebuilding outcomes. But we also know that the countries that get peacekeeping operations are also different from the ones that don't get peacekeeping. Usually, so peacekeepers are invited through a peace process. So these are countries where some kind of direction towards peace is already ongoing. So how do we disentangle the effect that peacekeeping missions can, contribute specifically in relation to the other processes that we might have had regardless of their presence? But also, you also talked about this tension that we might see. And I think that's something that has come out that I've also seen in my work and in others, in how kind of effectiveness in one area might undermine sort of progress in another. There are talks about how focusing on security might undermine democratization, for example, and creating legitimacy for local authorities. Or it might be that focusing on collaboration with host institutions to build and rebuild host institutions could also undermine efforts of protecting civilians when those institutions are also part of human rights abuses. So those are tensions that are real in many missions and where we as academics can try to provide tools for us, so trying to disentangle those and provide some evidence for how much of a tension there might be and to what extent there is a trade-off.
Yeah, I think this is a very relevant point, this tension that exists not just when we evaluate the missions, but also for the work that the missions are doing, in the sense that there's this discussion around mission potentially even enabling authoritarianism, work by von Willebeck and, say, at KCL. So all these works may indicate that, missions have to work out by making sure that, they achieve something, they can implement inclusive reforms, they can build sustainable peace, but then at the same time, they need consent from the government, because the government, as has happened in Burundi, they can declare UN officials, I think they did it with the Under Secretary General, persona non grata, which means basically you cannot really do your work there anymore. So there's also this balance the mission needs to strike. And that's the state building dilemma that people have brought up, people like David Lake as well. That's in a way the mission needs to work with the government, but also challenging, but not too much. So consent there really plays a relevant role. And I think there is now more attention also from academics on the role of consent, which we give for granted. I don't think there's a lot of thinking about quantitative work, not a lot of research on consent. How do we ensure that this consent remains there? It's sustained over time. And that seems to be without, of course, undermining long-term state building prospects.
So this focus on, so to say, aspects that have not yet been that have not been addressed by research or when looking at effectiveness, is actually quite a good transition to looking at peacekeeping data specifically. So we talked a lot about the mandates, but also what they do on the ground, what they should focus on or should not focus on, the different types of balances that they can strike. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how do we actually account for what peacekeepers do, or in the research design, do we have measures that go beyond the presence and absence of peacekeepers? How much information do we actually have on the peacekeeping side when we want to evaluate whether peacekeeping works or doesn't work? And whether you could tell us a bit more, maybe also about recent work and recent data collection efforts that you've been involved in this regard.
I think this is a field where we've also seen a lot of progress recently. So what type of data we need on the peacekeeping side depends on our theories and our expectations, right? So what is it that we, when we think that peacekeeping works, like how do we model it? Like what aspects of peacekeeping are important? And one direction that we've seen is to look at different types of peacekeeping operations. So, you know, more like at the very like aggregate like level of thinking about types. Are these multidimensional? Do they have a peace enforcement component? Are they more traditional, sort of observational missions? That's one aspect of like one way of unpacking the different types, a very heterogeneous, you know category of peacekeeping missions that we need to sort of then sort of find subcategories to understand how it works. Another direction has been to look at the actual resources and personnel that go into these operations. So some are very small, so with a few hundred people. Others have tens, thousands of troops deployed, along with police and civilian personnel, and getting more information about sort of how the composition and capacity of these missions change over time, provide us with more sort of leverage on understanding sort of what aspects of peacekeeping has those kind of effects. And a third way has also been to disaggregate spatially. So one thing is to think of the missions as a whole. So what is, you know, what capacity does the mission have, and what's the outcome on average? But we also know that these missions go to very large countries where it's impossible to be present everywhere. So there's a lot of trade-off and consideration in terms of where to deploy within these countries. So getting data on where they actually are deployed with their bases provide us more leverage of understandings of how they may be able to affect conflict in that area and what happens in the areas where peacekeepers are not present. And so those are a few directions. And Jessica can probably say more about directions in terms of understanding so what peacekeepers do and what they're mandated to do.
Yeah, definitely that's another direction that I think, well, at least for me, for my research, that I've looked more into. Mostly, I think most of the data that I've tried to collect relies on UN documents, right? So that's the main source that we use, publicly available document. I don't have access to special archives, I just use what it's out there. And so I think it really depends on which document and what is the data that you want to get out of the document. That, of course, comes with different challenges. The mandates, maybe a few words about which are the challenges of coding mandates using just the resolutions. So not knowing anything about, I mean, you can get some information about the debate around the mandate, but then other things going on, not even at the Security Council, you just don't know, right? You just don't know how tasks end up really in a mandate. At least, I don't know about this yet. Maybe someone, I guess, is working on that. So we've also worked, for example, on collecting data on civilian posts from the budgets. Those are straightforward. You can get them from the tables. The tables might have a weird formatting, just about cleaning it and make it usable, but nothing really about that can come with problems related to how we interpret the way the Security Council is speaking. But when it comes to mandates, there were a few difficulties. So we came up with this project with Anna Smith at the very beginning, and then we also reached out to Ksenia Ksamitna and Magnus Lundgren, who were working on coding few resolutions. So we were wondering about, like, rather than duplicating efforts, maybe joint efforts, also hearing from them what was their experience in coding these documents. And so we basically now have a coding of all African missions from 1991 to 2018, now extending it to other cases beyond Africa. And the real challenge has really been to go back to the documents in the 90s. The way mandates were written in the 90s was very different. The language was different. There was a lot of reference to, this mandate is just whatever it's in the peace agreement or whatever the Secretary General wrote in a letter. And sometimes the letter is very general. So the Secretary General may say things like, I hope the mission would achieve this, or I think, I suppose. So it's the language gets a bit tricky, and we're trying to code things that the mandate is requesting peacekeepers to do. So there's really an expectation from the Security Council that they will be checking on the missions, because then the Secretary General writes the reports on the progresses. And so there's some check that will be done on the missions. But then other tasks are just encouraged. So we rely a lot on these small hints, right, in the documents, the verbs, really, that the Security Council uses. And if you look at 30 years time span, you can imagine how this has changed over time. There are things you can do coding-wise regarding how to make sure that this is not too random or too inconsistent. So we code it twice. We have a bit of, we try to reconcile every discrepancy we have in the coding. So we try to do something with that. The data will never be perfect, I suppose, because we are in a way interpreting the mandates to some extent. But then it's a separate question how those that are sent to implement the mission read the mandate. So what is countries' understanding of what the troops are supposed to do? And that's another layer of complexity that really creates this divergence between what the missions are expected to do and what they end up doing on the ground, even in good faith. Just the way they understand the mandate, the way they decide to implement it can very much diverge. And I think that scholars we're now getting at this as like, these are two different processes. We cannot assume that whatever it's in the mandate will be implemented and that whatever is being implemented was originally part of the mandate.
Yeah, that is, I think you made some excellent points about what the sources you actually consult can give you and cannot give you, and that even UN sources are not a panacea for solving our data issues. I was wondering, with regards to spatial disaggregation, Lisa, that you also mentioned, what sources would you use or did you use to understand where peacekeepers are deployed and whether you have run into similar problems that Jessica just described?
Yeah, so I've been part of a data collection effort trying to compile data on where peacekeepers are deployed. And we use the deployment maps that the UN provides, which means that we get these maps and we have lots of locations with names. And then we have information on how many military units are present and which contributing countries in each location. And so we take those maps and try to transport that into a data set, which means that we need to find the coordinates, which is usually sort of a pretty straightforward exercise. This is something that, you know, a lot of data collection projects are working with, sort of finding, you know, connecting names to sort of geo coordinates. And I don't think there's a lot of error in that part. So that's kind of the first step. But then the second is, you know, trying to understand like how much, you know, what does the presence look like in each of these locations? And that's where we've seen kind of different strategies for making, for example, troop estimates per location in different data collection projects. And I think that's why it's also good that we have different efforts in trying to sort of interpret these documents that we get from the UN. But we've basically tried sort of to estimate, then if the UN says they have one battalion and two companies, you know, how many troops do we have in place, for example. That's, you know, the second step. And then the time frame is the third kind of challenge, where we get these maps, you know, and then there's an updated map, and then there's another updated map. So we can code each map, but it doesn't necessarily correspond exactly to the time frame that they are deployed. And we don't really know sort of how much changes between these maps. So those are things we just have to kind of assume and be transparent about how, whether we assume that deployments stay the exact same between these maps, or whether we can try to sort of extrapolate data and think of sort of, you know, think that they may change more dynamically sort of in between maps. But those are things that where we just have to, you know, take what the UN provides in terms of information, public information, and try to the best of our knowledge and capacity, construct data that we can work with in our analyses.
And I have to say that notwithstanding all the issues that come with coding this data, what Lisa and colleagues have been doing with this is just a huge public goods for researchers. working on conflict, working on peacekeeping. So I'm happy to take the estimate just for the sake of having the data there, which I think is an incredible coverage. It's a huge amount of work, and I'm glad that it's out there to be used. I think it's one of like the big, like the qualitatively different steps, something that allow us to know much more about missions that we used to do in the past.
So listening to you too, it seems like the data, academic data in the peacekeeping and conflict research area has evolved over time, has become more disaggregated, has branched into very different facets of peacekeeping, but also outcomes in terms of measuring whether peacekeeping works. And if we think about kind of parallel developments at the UN side, and for example, the very recent attempt by the UN Secretary General to foster a data-driven transformation of the UN to improve decision-making also in the field of peacekeeping. So basically increase the amount of data, increase the data use, make better decisions, understand what is happening, try to counteract problematic aspects and just make peacekeeping more effective. I'm wondering whether, if you were asked to give a piece of advice to UN practitioners in terms of the usefulness of academic data, what would you say this data or how this data can help practitioners to understand what is happening in the theaters that peacekeepers are operating in, why it is happening, and what may happen next?
Well, I think like many other, similarly to many other scholars working with data and do conflict and peace studies, I think this is a very important change, very welcome change for those who have been working on these. I can't count how many times I've heard the comment of, like, I'm researching this thing on peacekeeping. This is the data from public sources. It's imperfect. I'm sure the UN has the right data. I just don't have access to it. So I think that if this is the direction, it's very much welcome, I think, from the academic community. There are questions that just need better data and more data, particularly for the implication that they may have potentially for policymaking. And I hope the data strategy does not just involve collecting data or just putting the data on a portal for it to be available for most. Many times, I think academics have managed to like overcome the challenge of data availability, coming up with ideas like, for example, what Lisa mentioned before, right? We find a way. Probably the UN has the most precise data on who's located where, which month, which year, which day. But then I think we've overcome these kind of challenges. So I hope that the strategy involves more than that, maybe more knowledge exchange with academics that could be possibly be helpful in informing the data collection itself. Sometimes the data is there, but it's not really usable for many reasons. And you cannot just redo the collection, right? You have to use more resources to do that again. And also with the analysis of the data, I think there are interesting insights that academic can bring in this sort of policy evaluation that would be, I think, particularly interesting for evidence-based policy making. And on the three questions that you mentioned, I think on the what happened, I think this kind of data can be very useful. You can identify patterns that can tell you something about what happened. What will happen? I mean, I know about the Uppsala team, this is also part of that, having this views infrastructure that has been also been including this peacekeeping data successfully. So I'm sure she has more to say about this. But on the why it happened, I'm a bit more skeptical because there's more, it's a different kind of question that requires more work, it requires more theory building, if you want. So it's difficult oftentimes to get at the why question just looking at data. Depends very much on the data, but I think on that part, that's another part of the strategy where hopefully academic can be of more help to policymakers. I'm hopeful.
Yes, I'm also very sort of excited about the developments within the UN developing these mechanisms for collecting data. And I think sort of those efforts are very sort of clearly focused on sort of collecting data and thereby providing analysis on what peacekeepers do and what happens where they are. So we get a lot of detailed information about sort of the peacekeeping efforts. I think what we academics kind of bring to the table is that we also take a step back and look at the locations where peacekeepers are not present. And we look at the things that peacekeepers do not do and kind of add this point of comparison, which is important for understanding the bigger picture of how peacekeeping works and what happens within these contexts. So while the analysts at the UN are probably much more equipped to understand sort of the details in the specific context, we can provide kind of a framework and a context for making sense of that detailed data and to put it in relation to similar cases and provide a frame of reference for that analysis. So I think that's probably the most important. And I hope that the UN listens and wants to reach out to academics to, as Jessica said, make these data collection efforts as useful as possible, like for a wider purpose. So to enable answering and addressing different types of questions that are not only necessarily important for the mission as such in their sort of day-to-day analysis, but that will enable us to ask these broader questions that will be relevant to the UN also in the long run of how to run these operations.
Excellent. I would like to thank you both for taking the time to have this very important chat with us today. I think we've covered a lot of ground. Yeah, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Abby and Lisa. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. And I think the peacekeeping effectiveness literature and scholarship is also important for the political debates. I just wanted to add that. So it's not only for the practitioners, but also for policymakers in understandings of what peacekeeping contributes. I thought it was important to say that given the political debates we've seen about how mandates should be drafted and what resources should be given to peacekeepers. But I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, Abby.
Excellent. Thank you both so much.